Chapter 28 From the Diaries of Lindsay Mills. As far away from home as I was, my thoughts were consumed with Lindsay. I've been wary of telling her story, the story of what happened to her once I was gone. The FBI interrogations, the surveillance, the press attention, the online harassment, the confusion and pain, the anger and sadness. Finally, I realized that only Lindsay herself should be the person to recount that period. No one else has the experience, but more than that, no one else has the right. Luckily, Lindsay has kept a diary since adolescence, using it to record her life and draft her art. She has graciously agreed to let me include a few pages here. In the entries that follow, all names have been changed except those of family, some typos fixed, and a few redactions made. Otherwise, this is how it was from the moment that I left Hawaii. 5/22/2013. Stopped in at Kmart to get a lay, trying to welcome Wendy with proper aloha spirit, but I'm pissed. Ed's been planning his mother's visit for weeks. He's the one who invited her. I was hoping he'd be there when I woke up this morning. On the drive back to Waipahu from the airport, Wendy was worried. She's not used to him having to go away on a moment's notice. I tried to tell her this was usual, but it was usual when we lived overseas, not in Hawaii. And I can't remember any other time that Ed was away and wasn't in touch. We went to a nice dinner to distract ourselves, and Wendy talked about how she thought Ed was on medical leave. It didn't make any sense to her that he'd be called away for work while on medical leave. The moment we got home, Wendy went to bed. I checked my phone and found I had 3 missed calls from an unknown number and 1 missed call from a long foreign number. No voicemails. I Googled the long foreign number. Ed must be in Hong Kong. 5/24/2013. Wendy was home all day alone, thoughts just running circles in her brain. I feel bad for her and can only console myself by thinking how Ed would handle having to entertain my own mother by himself. Over dinner, Wendy kept asking me about Ed's health, which I guess is understandable given her own history of epilepsy. She said she's worried that he had another seizure, and then she started crying, and then I started crying. I'm just realizing that I'm worried too. But instead of epilepsy, I'm thinking, what if he's off having an affair? Who is she? Just try and get through this visit and have a good time. Take a puddle jumper to the Big Island at Kilauea. The volcano is planned. Once Wendy goes back, reassess things. 6/3/2013. Brought Wendy to the airport to fly back to Maryland. She didn't want to go back, but she has work. I took her as far as I could go and hugged her. I didn't want to let go of the hug. Then she got in line for security. Came home to find Ed's Skype status has changed to, sorry, but it had to be done. I don't know when he changed it. Could have been today, could have been last month. I just checked on Skype and happened to notice it. I'm crazy enough to think he's sending me a message. 6/7/2013. Woke up to a call from NSA Special Agent Megan Smith asking me to call her back about Ed. Still feeling sick with fever. I had to drop off my car at the auto body shop, and Todd gave me a ride back on his Ducati. When we pulled onto the street, I saw a white government vehicle in the driveway and government agents talking to our neighbors. I've never even met the neighbors. I don't know why, but my first instinct was to tell Todd to keep driving. I ducked my head down to pretend to look for something in my purse. We went to Starbucks, where Todd pointed out a newspaper, something about the NSA. I tried to read the headlines, but my paranoia just ran wild. Is that why the white SUV was in my driveway? Is that the same SUV in the parking lot outside this Starbucks? Should I even be writing this stuff down? Went home again, and the SUV was gone. Took some meds and realized I hadn't eaten. In the middle of lunch, cops showed up at the kitchen window. Through the window, I could hear them radioing that someone was inside the residence. By someone, they meant me. I opened the front door to 2 agents and a Hawaii Police Department officer. They were frightening. The HPD officer searched through the house as Agent Smith asked me about Ed, who'd been due back at work on May 31st. The HPD officer said it was suspicious when a workplace reported someone missing before the person's spouse or girlfriend did. He was looking at me like I killed Ed. He was looking around the house for his body. Agent Smith asked if she could see all the computers in the house, and that made me angry. I told her she could get a warrant. They left the house, but camped out on the corner. San Diego, 6/8/2013. I got a little afraid that TSA wouldn't let me leave the island. The TVs in the airport were all full of news about the NSA. Once on board the plane, I emailed Agent Smith and the HPD missing persons detective that my grandma was having open-heart surgery, requiring me to be off-island for a few weeks. The surgery isn't scheduled until the end of the month, and it's in Florida, not San Diego, but this was the only excuse I could think of for getting to the mainland. It was a better excuse than saying, I just need to be with my best friend Sandra, and also it's her birthday. When the wheels left the ground, I fell into a momentary coma of relief. When I landed, I had a raging fever. Sandra picked me up. I hadn't told her anything because my paranoia was off the charts, but she could tell that something was up, that I wasn't just visiting her for her birthday. She asked me if Ed and I had broken up. I answered, maybe. 6/9/2013. I got a phone call from Tiffany. She asked how I was doing and said she was worried about me. I didn't understand. She got quiet. Then she asked if I'd seen the news. She told me Ed had made a video and was on the homepage of the Huffington Post. Sandra hooked up her laptop to the flat screen. I calmly waited for the 12-minute YouTube video to load. And then there he was. Real. Alive. I was shocked. He looked thin, but he sounded like his old self. The old Ed, confident and strong. Like how he was before this last tough year. This was the man I loved. Not the cold, distant ghost I'd recently been living with. Sandra hugged me, and I didn't know what to say. We stood in silence. We drove out to Sandra's birthday barbecue at her cousin's house on this pretty hill south of the city, right on the Mexican border. Gorgeous place, and I could barely see any of it. I was shutting down, not knowing how to even begin to parse the situation. We arrived to friendly faces that had no clue what I was going through on the inside. Ed, what have you done? How can you come back from this? I was barely present for all the party small talk. My phone was blowing up with calls and texts. Dad, Mom, Wendy. Driving back up to San Diego from the barbecue, I drove Sandra's cousin's Durango, which Sandra needs this week to move. As we drove, a black SUV followed us, and a police car pulled Sandra's car over, which was the car I'd come in. I just kept driving the Durango, hoping I knew where I was going because my phone was already dead from all the calls. 6/10/2013. I knew Sandra's mother Eileen was important in local politics, but I didn't know she was also a fucking gangster. She's been taking care of everything. While we were waiting for her contacts to recommend a lawyer, I got a call from the FBI, an agent named Chuck Landowski, who asked me what I was doing in San Diego. Eileen told me to hang up. The agent called back, and I picked up, even though Eileen said I shouldn't. Agent Chuck said he didn't want to show up at the house unannounced, so he was just calling out of courtesy to tell us that agents were coming. This sent Eileen into overdrive. She's so goddamn tough, it's amazing. She had me leave my phone at the house, and we took her car and drove around to think. Eileen got a text from a friend of hers recommending a lawyer, a guy named Jerry Farber, and she handed me her phone and had me call him. A secretary picked up, and I told her that my name was Lindsay Mills, and I was the girlfriend of Edward Snowden and needed representation. The secretary said, oh, let me put you right through. It was funny to hear the recognition in her voice. Jerry picked up the phone and asked how he could help. I told him about the FBI calls, and he asked for the agent's name so he could talk to the feds. While we waited to hear back from Jerry, Eileen suggested we go get burner phones, one to use with family and friends, one to use with Jerry. After the phones, Eileen asked which bank I kept my money at. We drove to the nearest branch, and she had me withdraw all of my money immediately in case the feds froze my accounts. I went and took out all my life savings, split between cashier's checks and cash. Eileen insisted I split the money like that, and I just followed her instructions. The bank manager asked me what I needed all that cash for, and I said life. I really wanted to say STFU, but I decided if I was polite, I'd be forgettable. I was concerned that people were going to recognize me since they were showing my face alongside Ed's on the news. When we got out of the bank, I asked Eileen how she'd become such an expert at what to do when you're in trouble. She told me, very chill, "You get to know these things as a woman. Like you always take the money out of the bank when you're getting a divorce." We got some Vietnamese takeout and took it back to Eileen's house and ate it on the floor in the upstairs hallway. Eileen and Sandra plugged in their hairdryers and kept them blowing to make noise as we whispered to each other, just in case they were listening in on us. Lawyer Jerry called and said we had to meet with the FBI today. Eileen drove us to his office, and on the way, she noticed we were being followed. It made no sense. We were going to a meeting to talk to the feds. But also the feds were behind us, two SUVs and a Honda Accord without plates. Eileen got the idea that maybe they weren't the FBI. She thought that maybe they were some other agency or even a foreign government trying to kidnap me. She started driving fast and erratically, trying to lose them, but every traffic light was turning red just when we approached it. I told her that she was being crazy. She had to slow down. There was a plainclothes agent by the door of Jerry's building. He had government written all over him. We went up in the elevator, and when the door opened, three men were waiting. Two of them were agents, one of them was Jerry. He was the only man who shook hands with me. Jerry told Eileen that she couldn't come with us to the conference room. He'd call her when we were finished. Eileen insisted that she'd wait. She sat in the lobby with an expression on her face like she was ready to wait for a million years. On the way to the conference room, Jerry took me aside and said he'd negotiated limited immunity, which I said was pretty meaningless, and he didn't disagree. He told me never to lie, and that when I didn't know what to say, I should say I don't know and let him talk. Agent Mike had a grin that was a bit too kind, while Agent Leland kept looking at me like I was an experiment and he was studying my reactions. Both of them creeped me out. They started with questions about me that were so basic, it was like they were just trying to show me that they already knew everything about me. Of course they did. That was Ed's point. The government always knows everything. They had me talk about the last 2 months twice, and then when I was finished with the timeline, Agent Mike asked me to start all over from the beginning. I said, "The beginning of what?" He said, "Tell me how you met." 6/11/2013. Coming out of the interrogation exhausted, late at night, with days of interrogation ahead of me. They wouldn't tell me how many exactly. Eileen drove us to meet Sandra for dinner at some diner, and as we left downtown, we noticed we still had our tails. Eileen tried to lose them by speeding and making illegal U-turns again, and I begged her to stop. I thought her driving like that just made me look worse. It made me look suspicious. But Eileen is a stubborn mama bear. In the parking lot of the diner, Eileen banged on the windows of the surveillance vehicles and yelled that I was cooperating, so there was no reason for them to be following. It was a little embarrassing, like when your mother sticks up for you in school, but mostly I was just in awe. The nerve to go up to a vehicle with federal agents and tell them off. Sandra was at a table in back, and we ordered and talked about media exposure. I was all over the news. Halfway through dinner, two men walked up to our table. One tall guy in a baseball hat who had braces, and his partner, who was dressed like a guy going clubbing. The tall guy identified himself as Agent Chuck, the agent who'd called me before. He asked to speak with me about the driving behavior once we'd finished eating. The moment he said that, we decided we were finished. The agents were out in front of the diner. Agent Chuck showed his badge and told me that his main goal was my protection. He said there could be threats against my life. He tapped his jacket and said if there was any danger, he would take care of it because he was on the armed team. It was all such macho posturing or an attempt to get me to trust him by putting me in a vulnerable position. He went on to say I was going to be surveilled/followed by the FBI 24/7 for the foreseeable future, and the reckless driving Eileen was doing would not be tolerated. He said agents are never supposed to talk to their assignments, but he felt that, given the circumstances, he had to take the team in this direction for everyone's safety. He handed me a business card with his contact info and said he'd be parked just outside Eileen's house all night, and I should call him if I needed him or needed anything for any reason. He told me I was free to go anywhere. You're damn right, I thought. But that whenever I planned to go anywhere, I should text him. He said open communication will make everything easier. He said, if you give us a heads up, you'll be that much safer. I promise. 6/16/2013 to 6/18/2013. Haven't written for days. I'm so angry that I have to take a deep breath and figure out who and what exactly I'm angry at. Because it all just blurs together. Fucking feds. Exhausting interrogations where they treat me like I'm guilty and follow me everywhere. But what's worse is that they've broken my routine. Usually I'd tear off into the woods and shoot or write, but now I have a surveillance team audience wherever I go. It's like by taking away my energy and time and desire to write, they took away the last little bit of privacy I had. I need to remember everything that's happened. First, they had me bring in my laptop and copied the hard drive. They probably put a bunch of bugs on it, too. Then they had copies of all my emails and chats printed out, and they were reading me things I wrote to Ed and things Ed wrote to me and demanding I explain them. The FBI thinks that everything's a code, and sure, in a vacuum, anyone's messages look strange, but this is just how people who've been together for 8 years communicate. They act like they've never been in a relationship. They were asking questions to try to emotionally exhaust me so that when we returned to the timeline, my answers would change. They won't accept I know nothing. But still, we keep returning to the timeline, now with transcripts of all my emails and chats and my online calendar printed out in front of us. I would expect that government guys would understand that Ed was always secretive about his work, and I had to accept the secrecy to be with him, but they don't. They refuse to. After a while, I just broke down in tears, so the session ended early. Agent Mike and Agent Leland offered to give me a ride back to Eileen's, and before I left, Jerry took me aside and said that the FBI seemed sympathetic. They seem to have taken a liking to you, especially Mike. He told me to be careful, though, about being too casual on the ride home. Don't answer any of their questions. The moment we drove away, Mike chimed in with, I'm sure Jerry said not to answer any questions, but I only have a couple. Once Mike got talking, he told me that the FBI office in San Diego had a bet. Apparently, the agents had a pool going to bet how long it would be before the media figured out my location. The winner would get a free martini. Later, Sandra said she had her doubts. Knowing men, she said, the bet's about something else. 6/19/2013 to 6/20/2013. While the rest of the country is coming to grips with the fact that their privacy is being violated, mine's being stripped from me on a whole new level. Both thanks to Ed. I hate sending Chuck departure updates, and then I hate myself that I don't have the nerve not to send them. The worst was this one night sending a departure update that I'm leaving to meet Sandra and then getting lost on the way but not wanting to stop and ask the agents following me for help. So I was just leading them around in circles. I got to thinking maybe they'd bugged Eileen's car, so I began talking aloud in the car, thinking maybe they could hear me. I wasn't talking, I was cursing them out. I had to pay Jerry, and after I did, all I could think about was all the tax money being wasted on just following me to my lawyer's office and the gym. After the first 2 days of meetings, I'd already run out of the only decent clothes I had, so I went to Macy's. Agents followed me around the women's department. I wondered if they'd come into the fitting room, too, and tell me that looks good, that doesn't, green's not your color. At the fitting room's entrance was a TV blaring the news, and I froze when the announcer said, Edward Snowden's girlfriend. I fled the stall and stood in front of the screen, watching as my photos flicked by. I whipped out my phone and made the mistake of Googling myself. So many comments labeling me a stripper or whore. None of this is me. Just like the feds, they had already decided who I was. 6/22/2013 through 6/24/2013. Interrogation's over for now, but a tail's still following. I left the house happy to get back in the air at this local aerial silk studio, made it to the studio and couldn't find street parking, but my tail did. He had to leave his spot when I drove out of range, so I doubled back and stole his spot. Had a phone call with Wendy, where we both said that however badly Ed hurt us, he did the right thing by trying to ensure that when he was gone, Wendy and I were together. That's why he'd invited her and been so insistent about her coming. He'd wanted us to be together in Hawaii when he went public, so that we could keep each other company and give each other strength and comfort. It's so hard to be angry at someone you love, and even harder to be angry at someone you love and respect for doing the right thing. Wendy and I were both in tears, and then we both went quiet. I think we had the same thought at the same time. How can we talk like normal people when they're eavesdropping on all our calls? 6/25/2013. LAX to HNL. Wore the copper-colored wig to the airport, through security, and throughout the flight. Sandra came with. We grabbed a gross pre-flight lunch in the food court. More TVs tuned to CNN, still showing Ed and still surreal, which is the new reel for everyone, I think. Got a text from Agent Mike telling me and Sandra to come see him at Gate 73. Really? He came up to LA from San Diego? Gate 73 was roped off and empty. Mike was sitting waiting for us on a row of chairs. He crossed his legs and showed us he was wearing an ankle pistol. More macho bullshit intimidation. He had paperwork for me to sign in order for the FBI to release Ed's car keys to me in Hawaii. He said two agents would be waiting for us in Honolulu with the key. Other agents would be with us on the flight. He apologized that he wasn't coming personally. Ugh. 6/29/2013. Been packing the house for days now, with only minor interruptions from the FBI, coming by with more forms to sign. It's torture going through everything, finding all these little things that remind me of him. I feel like a crazy woman cleaning up and then just gazing at his side of the bed. More often, though, I find what's missing, what the FBI took. Technology, yes, but also books. What they left behind were footprints, scuff marks on the walls, and dust. 6/30/2013. Waipayu yard sale. Three men responded to Sandra's take-it-all best offer Craigslisting. They showed up to rummage through Ed's life, his piano, guitar, and weight set. Anything I couldn't bear to live with or afford to ship to the mainland. The men filled their pickup with as much as they could, and then came back for a second load. To my surprise, and I think Sandra's too, I wasn't too bothered by their scavenging. But the moment they were gone the second time, I lost it. 7/2/2013. Everything got shipped today, except the futons and couch, which I'm just ditching. All that was left of Ed's stuff after the FBI raided the house fit into one small cardboard box. Some photos and his clothes, lots of mismatched socks. Nothing that could be used as evidence in court, just evidence of our life together. Sandra brought some lighter fluid and brought the metal trash can back around to the lanai. I dumped all of Ed's stuff, the photos and clothes inside, and lit a book of matches on fire and tossed it in. Sandra and I sat around while it burned and the smoke rose into the sky. The glow and the smoke reminded me of the trip I took with Wendy to Kilauea, the volcano on the Big Island. That was just over a month ago, but it feels like years in the past. How could we have known that our own lives were about to erupt, that Volcano Ed was going to destroy everything? But I remember the guide at Kilauea saying that volcanoes are only destructive in the short term. In the long term, they move the world. They create islands, cool the planet, and enrich the soil. Their lava flows uncontrolled and then cools and hardens. The ash they shoot into the air sprinkles down as minerals, which fertilize the earth and make new life grow.